It's time for another GoldSeek.com radio episode. Today's featured guest, Arch Crawford from Crawford Perspectives. My featured guest today, Arch Crawford, combines technical analysis with the planetary alignments in astronomy to find patterns in the markets. Arch has been at the helm of Crawford Perspective.
It'll be 40 the 24th of May.
How about that? That's quite a tenure in the markets. Most people don't last more than a few years, but 40 years sounds to me like you might just be onto something. What do you attribute to your success?
Well, I was the first ever assistant to market technician Robert Farrell at Merrill Lynch, who was voted every year by institutional investor polls to be the best technician on Wall Street. I think he was every year but one during his entire reign at Merrill Lynch, and he's retired and still writes his own little thing for I don't know how many people, and I don't know what he charges for it, but he's a. I learned a lot while I was there at Merrill Lynch and studied a technical analysis before I went there, and I predicted the crash in 1962. I got there in like September of 1961 and predicted the crash of 62 after in the, I think, November of 61, and it popped in December and crashed. It broke. It made a huge multiple head and shoulder top, and it broke the neckline the day John Kennedy made the steel companies roll back a price increase.
If you were forced to put a percentage on technical analysis versus fundamental analysis, would I be right in guessing about 90 to 10, about a 90% favoring of technical?
I would say yes, only the other composition that I use more heavily is the astronomic cycles work, and I do weigh those much heavier than fundamental and somewhat under technical. The thing is, I like it when the technical confirms the astronomic cycles. That's when I've had my best hits, and I've been number one in the country several times in the regular market and a couple of times in the bond market and once each in gold. Yeah, I guess that's it.
Since you've given me the perfect segue into the yellow metal, your thoughts about the recent improvement that we've seen in, obviously, in the activity for the precious metals. You know, we've seen a remarkable rally. Of course, now we'd also seen that over the last 5 years, and each time the rallies fizzled out later on in the year. This time around, it looks as though the precious metals stampede might have some momentum behind it. What are your thoughts, please?
My thoughts are specifically that in the entire 5 years after the top, it never made an intermediate high above a previous intermediate high. Not once until this recent breakout.
And you know the irony there is? Gann's research, this unbelievable technician, didn't he accumulate something like $50 million, which back then would be multiples of billions of dollars today? 11 kids in his family, Texas. I think his father was a minister, a Baptist, and he just had this idea that he could apply mathematical, somewhat rigorous ideas to the markets, and it seemed to work for him.
And astrology. The early articles about him said the astrologer W.D. Gann, but he later than that, he silenced everybody who worked for him, had to sign a secrecy clause, and I actually met one of them once, and he said, yes, we did have to sign the secrecy thing, but we didn't know what he was doing anyway.
He didn't bother to tell anybody his inside info because he knew that eventually that would probably diminish the returns and his success. He kept his knowledge closely guarded, and, you know, I guess that's one of the reasons for these phone calls is we hope to garner our own W.D. Gann-like wisdom from Arch Crawford. Give us some of your inside tips.
In terms of the astrology, well, actually, basically, the cyclical things that are happening now are just regular mathematical cycles. We are getting into the time of year when they say sell in May and go away because the market has a strong tendency to top in late April or May, and bottom in October and November. We are at the point where that may kick in. Now, also, Joe Granville did a study on quarterly tops, talking about the relative to the earnings statements, so that your quarter starts off the first 5 or 6 days, nobody's reporting, and then they start usually the best ones earlier and the worst ones later. And that results in a high day. It doesn't have to be the high day of the quarter. It can be a high day for a few weeks and then a rally higher or not. But the high date that statistically comes out is the 18th or 19th calendar day of the month. Now, Joe Granville did that many years ago, and I caught it up in 1992, and it was still working. And I looked at it again like 4 or 5 years ago, and it's still working pretty well. As of April the 18th or 19th, that cycle kicks in. There's a cycle around the FOMC where the 2 days of the FOMC meetings tend to account for all of the major market gains of the last 2 or 3 years.
I have an article in this little humble dissertation I'm working on, peer-reviewed within the literature, within the field of finance and economics right now, and they claim that they found that 90, 92, and 94% respectively of the Dow, S&P, and the NASDAQ, they attribute to news events, i.e. key announcements such as your FOMC announcement you just alluded to.
Yes. Well, somebody did this study, and they reported on it earlier this year, I think, about the FOMC gains. And that was, I had noticed that, but I hadn't done any statistics on it or that. So anyway, so the typical high of the month is option expirations date, plus or minus 2 or 3 days, very often. Now, this year, it's been less so, but the last 3 or 4 years, it's been a very high ranking. Mostly it's a high, and when it's not a high, sometimes it's a low or within a day or two of a low. So I would watch those dates, the option expiration dates, the FOMC dates. So when we have 2 or 3 things that indicate a topping, like the 18th or 19th of April is the 18th or 19th of the quarter, that indicates a high. Then we had option expiration, I think it was the earliest one this month was the 15th. And now we're getting into May, which is seasonal time of the year.
You know what that reminds me of? The market adage, the axiom. We've all heard the sell in May and walk away, but way back, buy when the sap is running up the trees.
Gee, I don't remember that one, but it is true that early spring is probably the best time of the year, generally, statistically. And in December, of course, we have the December is the strongest month, regularly the strongest month. And then April, I think, is second.
I have a library of outdated, out-of-print finance tomes from the 1800s. This is J.P. Morgan's time we're talking about here, so this is way back.
Well, I share a birth date with J.P. Morgan, who had a full-time astrologer
yes.
on staff.
Yes, you know, you've mentioned that.
See, before 300 or 400 years ago, everybody who knew anything had studied astrology first.
Oh, yeah, Newton was a well-known astrologer. Johannes Kepler. Well, he picked up the work of Brahe, who was also a fascinating character. You know, he had
I have a book on astrology from him, yes.
You know, he had a silver nose. Are you aware of that? He had his nose sliced off in a duel, and he was a very wealthy man, so he just had a silver one. Of course, as you know, Kepler's mentor, more of a provider, they worked together. As you know, Brahe was the observationalist, the experimentalist, and then, of course, Kepler more of the theorist. So Brahe was a bit of an astronomer. But what he loved to do in the evening was throw these lavish parties. One evening, he consumed so much mead, I think it was at the time, that his bladder exploded.
Lord, that's a bit much, isn't it? I don't think even Ben Franklin did that.
The mathematical work on the ellipses and the elliptical orbits of the planets still astound astronomers today. You know, Newton probably borrowed some of that. It all really led to the calculus. I think you'd agree. He and Leibniz, it probably facilitated some of their work.
Well, those two independently discovered the logarithmic function.
You know who was really amazing there? Frederick Gauss. You might recall that he, as a young man, had memorized the logarithm tables to an extraordinary level. I'm reading this wonderful book, but two books simultaneously. They were so good, I found them at the same time. They're free online. Listeners who want them, I'll send you copies. It's only 200 or 300 pages. The imaginary tale of the square root of minus one, which, as everybody knows, a complex number or an imaginary number.
I have that book.
I can't put it down. Now, I think you'd enjoy Euler, the master of all of us. And I promise you, it's just as good as the imaginary tale of the square root of minus one. It actually might be better. Finished these two other books, The Man Who Knew Infinity and the other one called The Man Who Loved Only Numbers, that amazing life of a mathematician who was autistic, Paul Erdos. Listeners as well, just send me a request. I'll fire it over to you. Free, available online.
He's a long way back.
Well, no, Erdos, he sadly passed away, I think, about 10 or 15 years ago. There is an interesting documentary about his life. I think it was the Man Who Knew Loved Only Numbers. And he was a fascinating individual, never married, lived with his mother most of his life. And, of course, I think he was mildly autistic, which we now refer to. Well, we used to, in the American Psychological Association, we used to refer to that Asperger's.
No, autistic.
But now we refer to it as functional autistic. The American Psychological Association just struck Asperger's from their booklet there, and I think the reason why is they felt it was being overused. He was pretty heavily on the autistic spectrum, but he was very functional, and he just flew from town to town, didn't have a residence, and let other mathematicians take care of him. Do you know that my key mentor in university, he has a Paul Erdos number. People get numbers because so many people published work with him over his lifetime. He loved to collaborate with other mathematicians and economists and scientists. They take pride in their what they call their Erdos number. Yeah, one of my best mentors, by the name of Dr. Roger Tutterow at Kennesaw State University, he has a Paul Erdos number of 5. We're way off topic, but you got me on an area that that's where I spend all my spare time. The calculus, these brilliant minds like the Bernoulli family. If you ever want to read about a fascinating family.
I only know the one that was
Jacob Bernoulli, probably. But his brothers were remarkable as well. They worked side by side with Euler. They were contemporaries. Actually, Euler was a young man and made many breakthroughs with them and solved everything they couldn't in their legacy. This book is amazing. Riemann's Hypothesis, but I'll fire over a copy to anybody who wants it. And this is amazing. If you're interested in math and the zeta function and, of course, prime number theory and the prime number theorem, this is your book. Because this man, he only lived to 39, 40 years old, Bernard Riemann. And what he did in that brief period of time, I think in mathematics, it compares to Chopin, who died at 39, and maybe even Ramanujan, who passed away.
I was just thinking of maybe Ramanujan.
He died at like 29 or something like that. It was unbelievably early.
Quite young, but he really astounded Western science.
You want to know who else made a mark? And this will blow your mind. Died at 20. Galois. Galois. I'm probably mispronouncing it. My French-speaking people.
No, that sounds right to me.
He died in a duel the night after he formulated one of the most fascinating proofs in semi-modern mathematics, and his work is still being incorporated today. But I will agree with you on one thing. Ramanujan still blows me away. Just finished his book a few weeks ago, you know, The Man Who Knew Infinity. One thing that really struck me about him, it was all intuitive, Arch. He didn't rely on proofs.
It's intuitively obvious.
Exactly. So maybe we can draw parallels between Ramanujan and Arch Crawford today. It's intuitively obvious. I don't need proofs. And so let's get back on track here. Give us an idea of what's intuitively obvious. Give us an idea of what you see happening in the markets.
I was speaking for him that it's intuitively obvious. Now, I'll say, let me go one more if about the square root of minus one, the Zohar says, and no one that I know of has made this connection except me. The Zohar says, desire of desires, that which hangeth in that region which is negatively existent in the ancient one. And I'm saying that is desire of desires means square root. Why would he say desire twice?
I had this wonderful guest, David Gurwitz. He works with Nenner Research and Associates in New York.
I've heard that name.
Oh, yes. You'll hear of Charles Nenner and David Gurwitz. What's interesting is he's also a rabbi. And one of the things he's helped me with over the years is he said, you know, Chris, in our tradition, the word for prediction and knowledge and forecasting goes hand in hand with humility. And what you learn is that they're almost two sides of the same coin. Because I got so enthralled with the square root of minus one, i.e. imaginary numbers, that I threw myself into it for about a week. Oh, I know. A week, who cares? But, you know, I just absorbed everything that I could, and I came up with a couple little theorems, unproved, no proofs or anything, but a couple of theorems. There was this man by the name of B-U-S, I'm going to mispronounce it, Busey or something, and if you read the square root of minus one book, an imaginary number tale, they talk about it in there, that if you take the square root of minus one, that figure, and you take its reciprocal in the real world, and you combine them, you actually can glean future information. It was really quite a remarkable breakthrough. This is about 150 years ago, and I try to graph it. I try to illustrate his ideas, and I'll forward you. I've got several pictures here on my desktop. I'll forward to you what came out of it. It's got text and illustrations and whatnot. Because, you know, there's a saying in the math world today, Arch, the shortest path to information in our world is through the imaginary plane. So in other words, by learning to embrace the square root of minus 1 and minus 2 and 3 and 4 and up and down that imaginary line, ascending and descending on the imaginary line, there is a lot of knowledge to be gleaned. We've diverged again from the main topic. We'll give our listeners today so that we can keep the lights on here in the studio. Your feeling about the precious metals market, are the planets aligning in a way, are the technicals aligning in a way to where we could see a sustained rally?
Well, what I said in my most recent letter was that it's the best action that we've seen in the five-year period, and that if it breaks back above 1260, I would add to positions. And if it goes over 12, it did that already. It's at 1266 now. It's done it in the last 2 hours. So if it goes over 1260 to buy more, and if it goes over 1280 to buy with both hands.
You know, that's such an important point, because I think you pointed out that we've had a situation where higher highs and higher lows are just something we are, over the last 5 years, we've almost given up on.
Right. They're only just lower lows and lower highs. That's all we had.
You know, that tends to bring in a little bit too much exuberance in that one direction. Are there any astronomical anomalies that support this idea?
Yes. I'm looking for some kind of possible 2008 kinds of things happening this September, October. September tends to be the worst month, and we're now getting the eclipses in September this year. So that's a double whammy, in my opinion.
If you look at a weekly and a monthly, let's just pick the S&P, which I think tends to have one of the more solid trends of the three U.S. indices over time. They're really pronounced trends. That we've had what Edwards and McGee might refer to as a W-style bottom, or what some folks euphemistically refer to as a double bottom. Do you feel, Arch, that we're going to have to wait and see until October? And, of course, that's surprisingly close to the election time as well in November.
Well, don't get me started on that. My opinion is that we will have another false flag event, and perhaps even a larger one than 9/11, and that we won't have an election.
But wouldn't we be seeing telltale signs of that? I mean, wouldn't we be seeing lower lows and lower highs, not stocks breaking out to new highs? Give me just an example. Facebook, red hot this week, all-time new highs, hitting almost 122, I think it was. I'm just trying to give some perspective and some context. What are you seeing that makes you feel that extreme events could be coming?
You're talking about new highs on a couple of top stocks, some good movers. But here's the record going back a ways on the total New York Stock Exchange new highs. And at an important high of May 15th, 2013, there were 536 new highs, and they have trended lower with 472 in October 18th, 2013, 370 on June 6, 2014, 358 on October 31st, 2014, 350 on January 28th, 2015, 300 on March 20th, 2015, and the latest 218 on March the 30th, 2016.
Not too good, not too sanguine.
That's what you call lower highs.
That's what you call distribution back in the day.
Yes.
So what you're saying is the smart money is embracing these rallies as selling opportunities.
That's what I think. And also the fact that there's so many, much money has been pumped into the system, and that the government or the Fed or both are actively intruding into the market by buying index futures, even on an hour-to-hour basis now. Reagan started this, but they were not intrusive except if they were afraid of a crash at that time. You know, it was done right after the crash of 87. Over the last 5 or 10 years, they've become more and more and more intrusive.
So we're talking about the PPT, the Plunge Protection Team, organized purchases derivatives and leverage possibly through some of the investment banks on behalf of maybe the Treasury, and then again by proxy, our buddies at the Federal Reserve. Follow the money, Arch.
The thing is totally phony.
So you're trying to tell me, Arch, that things have gotten so good that people who can't find a job are tossing up their hands.
Well, I've also published charts, I think it was from Investors Business Daily, about the tax revenues from wages, and they show a different story entirely. So either they're lying about the employment numbers.
Fascinating story out of Great Britain this week. They're testing long-haul trucking all throughout Europe, driven by computer, completely by computer. And they're saying that within just not decades from now, but within years, you will see coast-to-coast shipments by these massive trucks that are fully automated through satellite and through self-contained computer systems. There are several car companies who are already putting safe braking systems that brake when you don't, if you accidentally take your eyes off the road and someone, you know, was to jump in front of you. And of course, I don't know if you heard this also, but I believe it was the CEO, Carl's Jr. I don't eat fast food, but I understand there's a restaurant called Carl's Jr. Yeah, I see. I don't have TV, so I'm kind of secluded from the world.
We have turned ours off for the last year and a half.
Good for you. Well, I'm 10, 15 years into it. Carl's Jr.'s CEO, I just want to finish this thought quickly, pointed out we're calling for 100% automation. So you would drive up, talk to a computer voice, swipe your card, and out the chute comes your bag of French fries, completely robotically made, and that's where they're headed. And is that going to be a problem from an economic perspective, or will we suddenly all just become programmers and things of that nature? It seems to me there's a big disconnect here. Any thoughts?
I would say that the opposite is true, that we're importing the programmers and we're dumbing down our own people. It's intentional. Well, they sent Jacobins over here to foment the Civil War. The bankers of Europe sent these people over here.
And you're saying that essentially the globalists have ransacked the Western world, and we're certainly starting to see signs of that.
Since before the Civil War, when they came over here and escaped their clutches.
And so what we refer colloquially here in the southern United States is the War of Northern Aggression. You're saying that now it's really a war of attrition by the entire country.
Somewhat, yeah. But in terms of the War of Northern Aggression, that's because General Lee ran Union troops out of the Confederacy, but he never attacked the Union.
Don't forget, he did attack Gettysburg. He made one assault up there into Gettysburg.
Into Pennsylvania, yeah.
Any contact information for listeners who'd like to sign up for your newsletters?
CrawfordPerspectives@earthlink.net is the email. www.crawfordperspectives.com is the website. Google Arch Crawford, you get about 15,000, and the first two or three are the website.
Thank you so much for making time for us, sir.
Superb. Thank you.
The gold and silver mining sector is red hot. Every investment portfolio needs precious metal shares. GoldSeek.com's top stock analysts have done it again, identifying the next solid gold nugget opportunity, Brazil Resources. Based in the 8th largest economy with a mining-friendly reputation, almost 10 million ounces of gold reserves, industry insiders are accumulating shares of Brazil Resources. The notable management team includes Chairman Amir Adnani, a rising star in the mining industry with a reputation for moving projects rapidly into production. Fortune magazine lists Chairman Adnani in the prestigious list of 40 under 40 ones to watch. Plus, shareholders benefit from the insights and backing of enigmatic Brazilian billionaire Mario Garneiro, CEO of Brazil Invest Group, the nation's foremost merchant and investment bank, and founding director. Their São Jorge project is 100% owned with paved highway access, a nearby workforce, and a hydroelectric power source near the major gold deposits. Their next top project includes three deposits identified by major gold producers, plus their Ria project, which is a joint venture with Areva, benefits from a $10 million treasure map in the hottest address for uranium production in Canada. But the story gets even more exciting with their Whistler project, offering geographic diversification in South Central Alaska. To find out more about this unique opportunity, please direct your web browsers to BrazilResources.com. At Yahoo Finance, ticker symbol BRI.V. Remember to ride the exciting gold stock run of 2016 and beyond. Your portfolio will thank you for adding shares of Brazil Resources.
GoldSeek employees may or may not own shares. Nothing contained herein should be construed as investment advice.